Thank you all for coming. Welcome back to all of our alumni. Welcome to Reunion 2016. My name is Mike Kelly. I am the head of the Archives and Special Collections here at Amherst College. And I'm just going to give you a brief introduction to a truly remarkable performance. Better. Can everyone hear me all right? Okay. Okay. I can talk loud. And so what I'm going to talk for maybe 20 minutes or so, and then we'll have a little bit of a break. And then the main event here is that you get to watch the full production of Julius Caesar that was staged by Amherst College undergraduates at the Folger Shakespeare Library in 1949. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit of that story. And feel free to, we'll have some time for questions at the end. And then we'll have a nice viewing of a pretty impressive production of Julius Caesar. So, as you may or may not know, and since I'm talking to a group of alumni, I'm going to assume that most of you do know, that Henry Clay Folger graduated from Amherst College in the class of 1879. Folger is a great example of a student who came from a financially underwhelming background, who through the support of the college and the support of his roommate's family, the Pratt family, Charles Pratt was his roommate, fellow member of the class of 1879, Folger was able to spend 4 years at Amherst College. He did not come from a wealthy family. But through his connections that he made here, Charles Pratt helped him to get a job that led to Henry Clay Folger becoming one of the leading executives in the Standard Oil Company of New York, eventually its president. And Folger's time at Amherst was very much of its time. I mean, here he is shown with the fellow members of the Alpha Delta Phi fraternity, and I always forget exactly which guy is Charles Pratt. I think Folger is right in the middle, and I think Pratt is the one to the right, or it might be the guy seated down to the left. I know Pratt always wore that kind of round-topped hat. But there they are, fancy upperclassmen with their canes and their hats, and you used to get your cane and your hat when you moved from being a freshman to being a sophomore. Now we give the canes away at graduation, so that tradition is still alive, though slightly altered. And the point that I want to make here when you're thinking about Folger's time at Amherst College is that Shakespeare was not part of the curriculum. Students were not reading Shakespearean plays. They were not studying Shakespeare as part of their coursework. The closest they would have come would have been speeches from plays like Julius Caesar for their public speaking competitions and their public speaking requirements. Public speaking was a huge part. Oratory was a huge part of undergraduate life at the college. And there is an exhibit that I'll reference several times as I speak over in Frost Library to go with the first folio that's on display at the Mead Art Museum. We've put together an exhibit that talks about Folger and Shakespeare and Amherst. And so we have, for instance, you can see the in his graduation year, Henry Clay Folger gave the Ivy Day oration. So this was a public speaking competition that he won, so he delivered the Ivy Day oration. And there were numerous prizes for public speaking. So his exposure to Shakespeare was not through the classroom. It was not the way that many of us have encountered Shakespeare today, where we, of course, you study Shakespeare in school. And biographers of Henry Clay Folger and scholars who've dug into his papers at the Folger Shakespeare Library, they all point to this. And on February 28, 1879, so the winter of his senior year at Amherst College, Henry Clay Folger attended a lecture by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I just like to pause here for a moment. This was not the first time Emerson had spoken at Amherst College, of course. But just the fact that Henry Clay Folger got to hear Ralph Waldo Emerson speak. And the lecture, the poster advertising that lecture is on display in Frost. And Emerson did not speak about Shakespeare in that lecture, but it did lead Folger to explore Emerson's essays. And so the volume Representative Men includes the essay, Shakespeare or the Poet. And that is the moment that most biographers cite as this is where Henry Clay Folger caught the bug. This is what made him, that turned him from, a smart, intelligent young man to someone who is passionate about William Shakespeare. And his wife shared that passion with him. So it really was, if you're familiar with Stephen Grant's biography of the Folgers, he really paints it as a portrait of two people working together toward a common love and a common goal. And so Folgers collecting begins, it's kind of crazy that these are, in 1889, he purchased a copy of the fourth folio, which is on the left. So that's the 1685 edition. What is on display, the first folio that's on display in the Mead, was printed in 1623. The fourth folio comes out in 1685. And it's a good, rare book. It's an interesting book. But the other item that he acquired in 1889 is the only known copy of Titus Andronicus. So that's a quarto play. It's one of those things that I like to say, you've seen one, you've seen them all. Thank you. So this was the beginning of Folger's serious collecting. And so he just goes crazy. I mean, he just buys up anything and everything. And he also has the entire communications and financial apparatus of the Standard Oil Company at his disposal. Whereas, another private collector who wanted to bid on a book at auction in London wouldn't have, a cable that went directly from his office to the London office of his corporation where he could send minions down to the auction house to increase the bids. So Folger really took full advantage of all of the privilege and power that came with his position in Standard Oil, which was, one of the largest corporations to ever exist back in its time. But let's shift gears back to Amherst College for a little bit. Like I was saying, there wasn't a lot of Shakespeare in the classroom, and there wasn't all that much elsewhere in student life. One of the earliest recorded Shakespearean performances of any kind is from 1881, when some students did a burlesque of Romeo and Juliet. This is slightly later. This is from 1908, and this is a production of Taming of the Shrew. I don't know if it's apparent from that photograph, but all the roles are played by men. Which was traditional at Amherst College. If you look into the dramatic activities collection of the 19th century, you will see a lot of plays where all the roles were played by men. And so this is the earliest proper, full production of an actual Shakespeare play that happened at the college, as far as we can trace. There may be earlier ones that we haven't found yet, but come on down to the archives and start digging. Slightly later, I thought it was odd that this was another Taming of the Shrew in 1913. I do not know about all of the actors. I can't quite tell. That would be a great research project for some student interested in looking at gender studies in early theater productions of college students. Anyway, that's a topic. And this, the 1941 production of Macbeth at Amherst College, is one of the most amazing visual things. This is just one of the set designs. We have many, many set designs. And this was in the Kirby Theater back when the Kirby Theater was still pretty new. So taking us right up to the 1940s, there's a growing presence of Shakespearean productions in the classroom and in student life. And so by the time we get to the 1949 production of Julius Caesar, we've got a pretty solid group of both students and faculty who are working on making these things happen. And this is really the guy. This is the man who makes it happen. F. Curtis Canfield, he's a class of 1925. He was professor of theater and dramatic arts from 1930 to 1954, director of the Kirby Theater from the time that it opened until he left Amherst in 1954. The first dean of the Yale University School of Drama from 54 to 67, and he was also a trustee of the American Shakespeare Theater Festival Academy from 62 to 68. So here's a guy who knows his Shakespeare. He knows his way around Renaissance drama. And he is the one who is responsible for bringing Julius Caesar to the Folger. Now, let's get back to Henry Clay Folger. While Amherst College students were starting to put together some Shakespeare productions and Shakespeare starts showing up on the college curriculum, in the meantime, Henry Clay Folger was amassing the greatest collection of books about Shakespeare, by Shakespeare, related to, Renaissance England in any way, shape, or form. He dies in June of 1930. And it's really important for everyone to remember that he was super secretive about the plans for his library. I mean, it was known that he was going to build a building in Washington, D.C., right across from the Library of Congress. He actually got the Librarian of Congress to argue on his behalf so that Congress would pass a law that would enable him to have that land. And then when his will was opened after his death in June of 1930, it was discovered that all of his books, a large portion of his fortune, and all of the land that he'd purchased for the library were left to the care of the trustees of Amherst College. And no one was expecting that, least of all the trustees of Amherst College. In what may be still the most unique gift the college has ever received, the greatest Shakespeare collection in the world. So Folger dies before the building is completed. And so the trustees work with Mrs. Folger to finish the design, complete the building, and in 1932 it finally opens its doors. And they built a theater inside the Folger Shakespeare Library. When it opened in 1932, there was the same theater that's there now. It is not a replica of the Globe. It is not actually a replica of any specific theater, but it's more of an Elizabethan-inspired theater. It has elements of Elizabethan theaters, but it is not slavishly imitating the Globe or any other specific theater. And partly because of that issue and because of other problems with it as simply as a public space, no one used it. From 1932, no full play was staged in that space until our students came along in 1949. So not only is it a student production at the Folger, it was the first full Shakespearean play produced at the Folger. But of course, they workshopped it out of town before they took it down to the big city. And so this is the poster from the Amherst College Maskers production of Julius Caesar that in 1949, they had several productions up here at the Kirby. And you can, if you follow all the details in the news stories in like the Amherst Student and other resources we have, you'll see that they ended up having to add additional dates. Because demand for these tickets was so high. So there was something special about this group. There was a real buzz about this group of Amherst College Maskers and this production of Julius Caesar. And we can credit Canfield with, you know, taking a bunch of 19, 20-year-old guys and making them into proper actors. And there was also a lot of publicity around it. The performance itself was on April 3rd, and so there are a number of news stories. Another item that's on display inside the archives over in Frost is the scrapbook that we have, where a lot of the pictures I'm showing you come out of this scrapbook. And people just saved all the clippings related to this production. And so there on the left, something from the Hampshire Gazette, local students in cast of play, which will be televised. And then on the right, it's in the Washington Post. The Washington Post is writing about Amherst College students are coming to town to put on this play at the Folger, and it's going to be on TV. And I think there's a really interesting media studies element here, big ads in magazines, you know, watch Amherst College Maskers on television, tune in 3:30 to 5:15 p.m. Eastern on WNBT. This is one of the great documents that's in the scrapbook. This is just one page out of a report. How many kids today would remember the time when we only had five television stations? I mean, six television stations. And at the time that Julius Caesar was being broadcast, half of those stations were not even on the air. And the other, so you either had Julius Caesar or a Western. And they don't even name the Western, because, you know, there might be some Westerns that compete with Julius Caesar. But this really gives you a sense of, you know, there were not that many television stations. This NBC, so National Broadcasting Corporation, is the network that broadcast the Julius Caesar production. They only had 17 affiliates at the time. So you can imagine NBC, national network, been around forever. It's like, no, there was a time when television was early, when, you know, and the Folger is still young. So this is really a fascinating moment in history of all these different new things coming together to celebrate something very old. I don't want to show too many of these stills because you're about to get to see the entire production, but this is just a lovely shot of with that big old 1949 television camera and some of our cast and crew together at the Folger. This is the whole cast and crew together at the Folger in the Folger's Theater. Everything's in black and white. The thing you're going to see is in black and white, but we do have some of the original costume designs down in the archives, and this is just an example of them. So try and remember that there was color when all of this was happening. And from this point onward, and even before, I mean, the production at the Folger comes at a moment when Shakespeare is clearly established. The Amherst Maskers are a student group with a reputation and with some history behind them, and Shakespeare just keeps happening at the college, as it does today. So this is Cymbeline from 1954. Here's a Henry IV Part I from 1958. And then we've got, we have, this is just tip of the iceberg. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of these posters. And many of these are on display in the archives right now. So you can, the idea of our show over in the Frost Library is some of these elements that, these artifacts from Henry Clay Folger's time here, artifacts of other student productions of Shakespeare, and then some other fun connections. We also do have our second folio on display. So, it's not the first folio, but it's still a pretty good folio. And we continue to send Amherst students. I mean, this relationship is a very strong and a very vibrant one for us. And every year, I didn't want to list everyone who's gone down there since 1996, but it did occur to me that we are in the 20th year of the Folger Shakespeare Library Undergraduate Fellows Program. And back in 1996, we started off sending just two students a year during interterm down to the Folger. Now we send up to six. And so just this past, and students go for 2 weeks during the January term, during interterm, and it has evolved from a program where students would pick their research topic, they would go down to the Folger and they would do their research. We do less of the throw them in the deep end and see if they swim approach nowadays. They go through half-day class meetings with experts at the Folger, so curators from the Folger. For instance, Heather Wolf, who is herself an Amherst College alum, she is the manuscripts curator at the Folger Shakespeare Library. And so when our students go down there, they get to spend half a day with Heather Wolf, who teaches them everything they ever wanted to know about Elizabethan handwriting, to the point of they learn how to cut their own quill and write with their own quill. They'll spend half a day with Aaron Blake, who is one of the curators of the art history collections at the Folger. So we're really doing a lot more work very closely with the students, pairing them with curators, pairing them with materials, and hopefully sparking in all of them that same experience that Henry Clay Folger had when he went and heard Ralph Waldo Emerson, and then something clicked for him, and he dug into Shakespeare as no one before him ever had, and as no one ever will be able to again. I mean, he has amassed the premier, unique collection of Shakespeare in the United States. And that pretty much takes us up to today. This is just a bit about the exhibit over in Frost. I believe the plan was to have a bit of a break, and then we'll start the broadcast, we'll start the film of the Julius Shakespeare at 3 o'clock. But stretch your legs if you need to, or I'm happy to take any questions and see if I can answer anything right now. Yes?
I just have a quick question. The Student Center fellows,
Yes. Yeah. As you might expect, we get a lot of students from English. We get some students from history, but we also get a lot of students from the classics department. I'm going to back up and just talk about some of these amazing people. I remember David Dickinson, who just graduated, who in 2014 he went and he was working on sententiae. He was looking for books of common phrases, like familiar quotation books, but from the Renaissance, he was curious about what were the classical authors that they were citing. And so he had this larger project in his head about how Latin school, the books of Latin that were used for education at different times influenced different writers. And so looking at those kinds of, and he had nothing to do with Shakespeare. So he was going there purely for the fact that they have a treasure trove of Renaissance era, Latin primers that would have been used by students. we had, in that same year, Daria Chenchevya, who was looking at Russian translations, earliest Russian editions of Shakespeare. And students may go down with only the vaguest idea of what they want to study, but that's what that work with the curators helps them figure out. So if you're talking to, we had another student, I'm forgetting which one it was, but he was interested in the Henry plays. And Heather Wolf pointed out, like, well, the Folger actually holds a unique manuscript where someone very close to Shakespeare's time took Henry 4, 1, and 2, and Henry 5, and smushed them together and made their own version of a play, and no one's ever looked at that manuscript before. So that's the kind of thing that we're trying to foster more of. Instead of, I'm interested in this, go look for it yourself, we try and foster that. Yes?
Do the Amiskata students have anything to do with Massachusetts Center for Renaissance Studies? They put up Shakespeare and play.
I don't know. I mean, not formally, not officially, but we have been partnering with the Renaissance Center. We actually coordinated a lot of our first folio events with them. For instance, they had a production of Romeo and Juliet that we couldn't have asked for better planning. It was on the weekend of Amherst College commencement. It's like, okay, the one weekend we can't do anything else around here, Renaissance Center had that covered. And so that's working out very well. But I think our students are aware through the faculty that that's a resource for them. Yes?
I think I might be asking for a repeat because I came in late. But did I hear you say that studying Shakespeare in college wasn't common?
Correct, in the 19th century. In the 19th century.
I'm remembering, for instance, Louisa May Alcott remembers or writes of her fictional characters knowing Shakespeare and talking about Shakespeare. So some people know it.
Oh, yeah, I did not say that no one knew Shakespeare. I just said that nobody was teaching Shakespeare as part of their college curriculum. So, you know, Emily Dickinson had a very thorough knowledge of Shakespeare, and you can go hear Perrick Finnerty, who wrote the book Emily Dickinson's Shakespeare. He's going to talk about that tonight in this very spot.
What do we infer from that it wasn't taught in a college?
That college curricula were very, very different 150 years ago. I mean, that's really it. They were still very much about the classics, moral philosophy, some natural philosophy, theology, and then a little bit of science. And even the science part was radical. To get to the point where we are, where people study literature, from my own field, I know the journal American Literature was not founded until 1929. So, I mean, these things that we now take for granted, if you go back and look at the college catalogs from the 19th century, like the 1870s, 80s, 90s, they're not studying the great American novel. They're not studying theater. They're not studying, that's the whole point about Canfield being the first dean of drama at
54.
Yeah, so that's when... Yeah, and I think one of my other favorite tidbits I'm probably misremembering is, Oxford University didn't teach any 20th century literature until 1970. Things we assume, it's like, of course, Shakespeare's great. It's like, yeah, and that's for your own time. If you're at college, you're studying this, this, and this. So, but that's what the students did, was they pursued Shakespeare on their own. And so that was extracurricular, just exactly the same way that Emerson was absolutely not part of the undergraduate curriculum, but you would have a chance to see Emerson come through and get hooked on your transcendentalist that way. So it really is. I think part of what I do a lot of in my job is conveying to everyone just how very different the Amherst College of the 1880s is from the Amherst College of 2016, from the Amherst College of... I'm going to guess that those of you who are coming back from the classes of the 50s and 60s, things might seem a little bit different than they were then. So, I mean, that's just, it's always happening. And so now Shakespeare's part of everybody's curriculum. Yes?
So, following up your comments about curriculum, could you, as briefly as you can, sort of tell us a little bit about the evolution and the natural science curriculum?
Ooh. I am absolutely unprepared to discuss that. I know we have materials. I know that President Meeklejohn had some very new ideas, and I know there are folks out there whose names are escaping me who are supposed to be coming in tomorrow to do some work on Meeklejohn's material. All I can say is the material to do that exact research, we have it. And I would say college catalogs are a great place to start. and all our college catalogs are online. No one has taken a break. We're supposed to take a break and start the film at 3, but if anyone has any final questions, I'm happy to field that, but we should have a brief pause.
I can't wait to see
it. Okay. Oh, and there is, the film is about, it's about an hour and 45 minutes. There is an intermission, but during the intermission, they actually have President Charlie Cole gives a little address, and then the director of the Folger in 1949 gives some comments about the Folger. So we'll take just a few minutes. Everybody stretch your legs, wet your whistle, and then we'll come back and start the film.